Now here on RTE Radio 1, it's time to join Sean Rocks for our Culture Night edition of Arena.
Tonight on a special Culture Night Arena, John Boyne, Claudia Boyle, Doughty and many more artists share with us their cultural highs. Hello and welcome to this Arena Culture Night special. Well, it certainly has been a dark period for the arts in recent times. But for this Culture Night 2021, we're going to celebrate what the arts do for us. So as you head out to visit your local gallery, bookshop, art centre or theatre, let Arena be your soundtrack for the next hour. Or if you're happy to sit on the sofa or potter about the kitchen at home, let us entertain you there. We've asked some of our great artists to share with us their cultural highs, what pieces of work have sustained them, challenged them or delighted them throughout their lives. And remember, right across RTE, you can join in the Culture Night experience by logging on to rte.ie/culture for Come Together. RTE celebrates Culture Night. We have two extraordinary panels for you this evening to share their cultural highs. First off, the author of The Echo Chamber, The Heart's Invisible Furies, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, and a few other books besides, John Boyne. Beside him, star of the world's opera stages, soprano Claudia Boyle, and electronic music's wunderkind, Doughty O'Droney, who with his houseplants partner, Paul Noonan, release their debut album, Dry Goods, this very day. Mm-hmm. And in the second half of the programme, we will have a change of contributors. I'll be joined by actors Roxana McLean, Emmett Kerwin, and singer Jess Kavanagh. More about that later. Let's begin with a little Kate Bush, who gave John Boyne a cultural high. This is Dream of Sheep.
Little light shining. Little light.
Bush there and Dream of Sheep, and that from her 1985 album Hounds of Love, the first choice of John Boyne on this Culture Night. John, it's not just that song and it's not just that album, it's the song cycle itself, the ninth wave. It's a kind of suite of songs.
Yeah, Hounds of Love came out in 1985, as you mentioned, when I just turned 14. And I became completely obsessed at that time with Kate Bush, and I have been ever since. That version of And Dream of Sheep actually was from the live concerts a few years ago, which I went to see. And her voice is so much deeper, actually, 30-something years later than on Hounds of Love. But that second, what we used to call a B-side of an album, and it isn't a B-side anymore, but is a suite of songs about a woman drowning. And it starts with that, a woman, she's skating on ice, and she falls onto the ice. And she starts to have all these memories of life, and will she survive, and so on. And it's what you know people used to call the concept album a lot. And it's just one of those albums that you know I can listen to week after week, and I have been listening to it for 30 something years. And you find something new in it every single time.
And obviously, you said you saw her live. Have you seen her live much?
No, she has only performed one set of concerts since 1978, and that was about 4 years ago when she went back to the Hammersmith, what's now the Apollo Eventum, I think, in Hammersmith, and for a series of concerts, and she just never performs live, and she did it, and I got this, well, this isn't great for radio, but you can see I have a tattoo here on my right arm, which says Wave After Wave, which is from the back of that album, which says Wave After Wave, each mightier than the last, from Tennyson's The Ninth Wave.
All right. And I thought actually you were going to show me Kate Bush in a tattoo there, because I thought, was he cogging? Was he cheating in University Challenge when he represented the University of East Anglia?
Oh, very well done. Yes. And we got to the final.
So what has Kate Bush got to do with that?
One of the questions was, very well done. One of the questions was, I remember Jeremy Paxman said, Kate Bush's words for snow, Paul Simon's ways to leave your lover, and then I buzzed in, and it was 50. 50 Words for Snow, because that was Kate Bush's most recent album. Actually, it's about 10 years ago now, because she only does one every 10 years or so. I wish she'd do more, but
Not surprising in some ways. There's a big storytelling aspect to the way John described that suite of songs, Claudia, and it's also interesting to see what kind of people put down as a first possible choice. Nothing to do with the world of opera, but despite the fact that before all of this madness started and pandemic hit the world, you made your Royal Opera main stage debut at Covent Garden in 2019-2020 season. Gerald Barry's Alice's Adventures Underground, playing the title role of Alice there. But it's not an opera. I thought you might go to the world of opera first. The world of visual arts, and specifically Salvador Dali.
Oh yeah, Dali. I have to say I'm always drawn to his works. And I love art. I've always loved art. I studied art in school. But Dali, like back in the day, Sean, when, you know, we didn't have smartphones, I remember I had a little, I think it was a Siemens Savvy phone when I was going into my first year in college. And in the Royal Art Academy, they had this poster of swans reflecting elephants, you know, and rather than being stuck in my smartphone when I was waiting to go into my lesson, I'd just be looking at this picture, you know.
And can you describe that, you know, swans reflecting elephants, because it's swans kind of above the water and then the reflection underneath.
Yeah.
They look like elephants.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just this stunning piece of work with three swans and then and they're on a lake. And then if you look into the lake, then exactly as if you just turned the painting around, you see three elephants, and it's something you wouldn't necessarily think of, but it actually just works so brilliantly. But that's what I love about his work. You just find things in it all the time. And actually, I have a poster of that at home, and it's lovely to see my little girl just gazing up at it all the time and asking me, and she finding the elephants and the swans herself. And I love that. But especially, I mean, he was classically trained. He graduated in, you know, very fine art. So he does have a very refined style, but with these beautifully abstract ideas.
And also there's a kind of a drama in some ways in Dali's work, isn't there, that perhaps isn't 1,000 miles away from the emotional ups and downs and turmoils of the operatic world?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's so much drama. I mean, and another one of my favourites is The Persistence of Memory. Actually, that's probably his most famous painting. And there's just so much in it, but everybody sees different things, and that's what I love about it as well. You know, the famous melting clocks, and people were, you know, saying, oh, well, what does that mean? Is it, you know, is you know, what is time? Every second that passes, like, there is no present. There's only history, and there's only history and future. And then I remember I was reading up a journalist asking Dali, like, was this based on Einstein's theory of relativity? Mm. And he just said, no, it was a bit of Camembert kind of melting in the sun. So, you know, like, it's funny. You can find, you know, and anybody can find something in anything, but especially his. I just think there's such depth there. But you're right, it does relate to what I do. I mean, there's plenty, certainly on a personal level, and there's plenty of ups and downs in the job. It's, and certainly in the last year and a half, there have been. So it's, very relative.
Today, Dahi, must be an up day. I mentioned about yourself and Paul Noonan and the Houseplants.
Yeah.
New album. Did you choose Culture Night and Culture Day, as it were, specifically for the release?
We actually didn't. No. We picked a day where we were trying to hold off for as long as we can so we could get these amazing live shows down and kind of get out to perform and stuff. Mm. And we got as far as this date and went, like, okay, this is enough. We'll just get it out there as quick as we can. But yeah, it's great to get it out there finally. And it's been a kind of a year and a bit of work. And we're super excited to perform it for people.
Your first choice for us this evening, a German film from 2015 called Victoria. Tell us a little bit about this film. And I think it's been, this has been an inspiration, a bit like John was saying about Kate Bush. This has been in your psyche, I think, for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a Sebastian Schipper film. It's a kind of a one-shot, one kind of take film that's told kind of throughout a night in Berlin, where a woman who is on her own begins in a kind of a nightclub and kind of comes out of a nightclub and meets this this group of kind of strangers she'd never met before. And basically, you're following these characters throughout the city of Berlin. And it's a really incredible film, because usually when you're watching a film, there's kind of these cuts and you're suddenly in the next scene, and there's kind of like you're suddenly in a new world or whatever. But a one-shot film is really, really incredible, because you are just with these characters the whole way through, And as a musician, it's one of the most inspiring films in terms of music, because it does this, it has a way of moving from, say, a scene to a scene by basically, you know, they'll be up on top of a roof at one point and then they'll go, okay, well, let's go to this other area, and they'll go down and the sound will cut out and this beautiful, beautiful soundtrack from Niels Fram will start playing, and it has this like incredible closeness of a piano, and you can hear every creak in the piano, and it's just this really, really powerful, intimate thing where you're stuck with these characters throughout the entire film, and it's just really, really powerful.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little bit of the Niels Fram soundtrack then from Victoria. It's so extraordinarily calm, Barry, that soundtrack, because the energy of the film itself, because it is this single take, it's like you're breathless the whole way when you're watching it.
Oh, it's an absolutely incredible film, and I have spent many, many years inviting people to my house and taking their phones off them, basically, because I'm like, if you're going to watch this film, you're going to watch every single frame, and the second you look at a phone or you look away, you are breaking the shot, so you need to stay on this couch and watch this film from start to finish, and it is just an absolutely incredible film, just really, really powerful, and the music just kind of adds this kind of closeness and power to it that's really special. Yeah,
we'll put Dahi in charge of the phones around the opera houses of the world, Claudia.
Absolutely, we need less of them. more art.
A rule with an iron fist.
John, a painter you're bringing us to for your second choice this evening. Born in Macedonia, based in Sydney. Who are we talking about, first of all?
It's a guy called Steve Kaltsev, and I'm a real Australiophile. I spent a month there every year for the last 15 years, up until the last 18 months, obviously. And I just love Australia. And when I started going there, I became very immersed in Australian culture and history and art. And I found this wonderful gallery in the Rocks in Sydney, which is just around from the Circular Quay where the Opera House is, with so many wonderful artists in it. But this guy, Steve Kaltsev's work really spoke to me. And he does these enormous canvases of, they're very, very tactile. It's oil. He works mostly in oil, but it's very brought out from the canvas.
Yeah, they almost look like sculptures in some ways. Yeah. Or certainly collages. There's quite a lot of texture to them.
Yeah, there's one in my hallway. I have this one that fills the entire wall, and it's like an old fossil. It's like something you might see on a big rock somewhere, and it's beautiful. You know, it's just there's also a real element of the Aborigine in it. I think, and these sort of dreamscapes, because he doesn't paint kind of, you know, men or women or houses or anything like that. It's always these kind of strange designs that, you know, really feature through almost like hieroglyphic ways in Australian culture.
Yeah, I was looking at some of them online, and there's one of the paintings that contains these concentric circles. There's another one that has these as you described them, lines. And when I looked at that Aboriginal tradition, it kind of spoke to me in some ways like Celtic art. You know, yeah. The Ouroboros, with not quite concentric circles, but also the lines of Om. It struck me that there were similarities there.
There are, now that you say it, yeah. In fact, I have one in my living room that is quite like the lines of Om, all right. But actually, as I was sort of preparing for this coming in today, and I was just looking up a little bit about him, and I was really sad to find out that he died last year. And every time I would go to Sydney, I would nearly always go into that gallery to see what was new by him and see, you know, was there something to buy? And I was just very sad to find out that he had died. But his work is just, it really, really gets me in some way.
Yeah. And there's a kind of a drama in as you describe it there. And again, we're into the world of drama with you. And I suppose the sister art form of opera, we could describe ballet in that way.
Absolutely.
Claudia?
Yeah, it's so closely linked. I mean, it's so heightened, it's so dramatic. And actually, I was introduced to ballet very young. My two sisters went to Russia for a year to study ballet when they were just 13. So it was in our family a lot.
Wow, and off to Russia with the pair of them, yeah?
Yeah, when they were and they're twins. So they went off when they were 13 to Perm. to study for a year. And then actually a lot of the Russian teachers then came back and we did a lot of ballet lessons. So I always loved it.
Did you do much yourself?
I did, yeah, up until about 15, 16. I did a lot of ballet, but no, it's really reinforced what I do, how you move on stage, how you use your body, you know, the shapes you can do. And certainly if you're doing a more abstract production, I mean, in Italy, the productions will be maybe a little bit more traditional. But if you're working in Germany, somewhere like that, you know, you're very likely to get a more abstract production. So, you know, having background in ballet and dance really, really, really helps.
And you've chosen Giselle as the ballet at Alpha Dam. This is really the heartbreaking, probably the most heartbreaking of ballets, isn't it?
Oh, Sean, it's aired most Christmases along with, let's say, the Nutcracker ballets like that. Mm. And yeah, it just gets me. I mean, it's a story of a simple girl called Giselle who meets a man who's a nobleman but disguises himself as a peasant. Then they can't actually be together and she's so brokenhearted she passes away. And then she's destined to become a spirit of the woodland called the Willies. Mm. And they basically lead men to their death by dancing them to exhaustion. Mm. And then she saves him at the end. But the music is just so beautiful. It's so profound. And there's so many points in the opera that just make you want to weep. I mean, when she first finds out that she's been betrayed, you know, she dances the steps that she danced with him, but she's faltering and you can see her heartbreak. And then suddenly she turns around and she sees her mother and she runs to her mother and then just drops dead. Mm. And I just think that is just one of the saddest things. I mean, when people are close to death, they do want their mothers. Mm. So many beautiful, poignant moments in it. And then I think you're going to play a little bit from the finale. But here she has saved him from the curse of the Willies, even though that he has betrayed her. And she's, of course, on point, tiptoe, going down to her grave again. And he's hugging her, trying to stop her, trying to stop the inevitable. But the music of a flute, just a solo flute, and a beautiful ascending line, and she descends into her grave.
Closing section there, the finale from Adolphe Adam's music for the ballet Giselle, one of the choices of Claudia Boyle on this culture night. Yeah, the hankies are almost at the ready.
I know,
it's so delicate, isn't it?
It's so delicate, it just pulls at the heartstrings. And then, you know, I have such admiration for ballet dancers. I mean, what they do is just unbelievable. I mean, they're athletes, they're artists, and then they make it look so easy, and it's anything but. So, yeah, it's amazing, all of those things combined.
You know, there's a kind of it's a similar type of emotion, I think, in the second piece that you've chosen for us, Dahi. And you could argue, I suppose, in some ways, the music video is a kind of a modern ballet, isn't it, in some ways? It may be a short ballet. This is from the French duo, The Blaze. Tell us a little bit about them, first of all, and this piece that you've chosen. I watched it, it's about 7 minutes, but it's an extraordinary, real emotional journey.
It really is, yeah. So The Blaze are kind of a house music producing duo who live in Paris. Jonathan is one of them who started as a filmmaker first. So they kind of come at music in a very interesting way. Usually if you're releasing and writing music, you write a piece of music and then you start going through the promotion of it and you make a kind of a video to kind of promote the track, whereas The Blaze come at it from a completely different angle where they think of the music video first and then basically create their music based off what they're going to do to make the film. And Territory, which is one of their kind of lead singles from the last album, is probably their best video in my eyes. You're right. It is kind of like a modern ballet, but I think one of the things that is really, really special about music videos as a whole is this idea that music videos don't actually have to have a beginning and a middle of an end. They don't have to have like this kind of storyline. Mm. All you have to do is just be able to be kind of transported into a world. And with Territory, you get this amazing world where you're kind of, it raises a lot of questions at the start. You're kind of, you just know that a person has come back. It's set in Algeria. A guy has come back from somewhere, we don't know where, and he's welcomed back by his family and his friends. And I think the best thing about this video is that it's a kind of a study on masculinity, but in a really, really positive way, which is incredibly hard to do, I think, in today's world. And it has this amazing kind of, there's a beautiful sense of kind of loyalty and happiness around him and his friends and his family, and you can kind of see what he holds dear, and it's an incredibly uplifting and fun video as well.
Well, let's listen to some of the music from the Blaze, then the duo, and the song Territory.
We shed some tears of love now, like a desert in the rain, when son of the dead I wake up. There's nobody like my mom. There's no place like my home since I was born. When I was young, the flavor is so strong. I've missed it so long, yeah.
And that's the opening section there of Territory from The Blaze. Back with more on this Culture Night special after this break. Welcome back to this Arena Culture Night special with my first star-packed panel, novelist John Boyne, soprano Claudia Boyle, and one half of Houseplant, producer and musician Dahi O'Droney. And remember, all across RTE this evening, you can join in the Culture Night experience by logging on to rte.ie/culture for Come Together. RTE celebrates Culture Night. John Boyne, third cultural high. You had to give in to literature eventually, but what a piece of literature you chose. Poetry you went to, not
yes,
prose.
But not a novel. And I'll make a confession. I don't know if Claudia or Dahi find an art form close to their own that they struggle with, but I've always struggled a bit with poetry. I've tried, and it just, I really struggle. It's my failing, I think. But somehow The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, since I was a teenager, has just really grabbed me. I think it always feels like a big puzzle. Every time I read it, I find I understand a little bit more. And it is one of those things that you need to have read so many other things to understand it, really, you know, because it's got so many allusions to, you've got like the Holy Grail and the Fisher King and the First World War and modernism. You know, everything is really thrown in there. And there's so many different, in the five different sections of it, all recounted in different styles, different tones of voice. My favorite one being where the women in the bar are all kind of shouting over each other and, you know, talking to each other. And it's the one piece of poetry that I seem to go back to time and time again and read.
Comedy is where you're bringing us, Claudia Boyle.
I know. You didn't see that one coming,
that one coming, no.
I'm just a big lover of stand-up comedians, I have to say. I just, again, always stand back in admiration of somebody who can come out and be themselves and be funny and entertain. And I just find that unbelievable. It's so impressive.
George Carlin. Why George Carlin?
Oh, God, he was amazing. I mean, why not George Carlin? I mean, I think he's one of the most prolific comedians out there. I mean, he inspired so many after him. I think he was voted like number two, second only to Richard Pryor in top 500 comedians. But apart from being very, very funny, he had a lot to say. I mean, he had depth. You know, he had a huge amount to say on culture, on you know,
religion,
social conforms, and religion and politics. And but then, you know, I don't like my comedians too highbrow all of the time. He could be obscene. He could be silly, you know. Yeah. And not only what he had to say, but how he said it. I've never heard George Carlin stumble. He was such a proficient, eloquent speaker.
Let's hear him in action.
But in the bullshit department, a businessman can't hold a candle to a clergyman. Because I got to tell you the truth, folks. I got to tell you the truth. When it comes to bullshit, you have to stand in awe of the all-time champion of false promises and exaggerated claims, religion. No contest. No contest. Religion Religion easily has the greatest bullshit story ever told. Think about it. Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day. And the invisible man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish, where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. But he loves you.
George Carlin taking no prisoners and offending half the country, I'm sure, in that particular clip. Finally, Dahi, then, a video game to finish up with, trying to bring me into the world of...
Do you play much video games, Sean?
Not that many. Death Stranding, tell us more.
Yeah, I just thought it would be an interesting thing to add into this kind of mix, because in terms of an art form, you know, it kind of gets a bad rap, I think, a lot of the time. I think part of the reason of that is because video games have a huge amount of money surrounding them, so you kind of... You know, it always kind of muddies the water sometimes with art forms if there's too much money involved. But Death Stranding is from a video game maker called Hideo Kojima from Japan. It's an absolutely incredible, dense mix of kind of metaphors. It kind of explores all sorts of things like fatherhood and death and a whole pile of different ways and a huge amount of different metaphors. But kind of most importantly, and the reason why I love video games as a kind of an art form is because they're such an extreme escape. You know, there's no other art form that kind of mixes music with visuals and then also this kind of very like personal, like encapsulating, you are actually controlling a character on the screen. And when people get it right and it's a really, really good form of the art, you get to just kind of be in this world and escape from your own one in a kind of complete way, which is super special.
And one brief question, how long did you play this before you shot anybody?
I haven't shot anybody.
And you've played it for hours and hours.
And I've played it for hours. And this video game in particular, Death Stranding, doesn't have any guns in it at all. This video game is basically, you know, you, after a long day of making music, I sit down and basically I go from one bunker and I pick up some packages and I walk through this amazing kind of place that looks like Iceland or Connemara, and I get to the next bunker and I deliver it. And that's what I do.
And
I love
you
it.
Shoot nobody along the way.
Well, I don't shoot anybody, I promise.
Thanks very much to Dahi O'Droni and to John Byrne and Claudia Boyle for sharing their cultural highs on this Arena Culture Night special. Remember, you can catch up on RTE Culture Night celebrations across all of our services. rte.ie/culture will bring you to that. Back with three new guests after this break. Welcome back to this Arena Culture Night special, where we've invited some of our favourite artists to share their cultural highs with us as a soundtrack to your own Culture Night odyssey, be that at home or out and about, going to events in your local gallery, theatre or library. John Boyne, Claudia Boyle and Dahi O'Droni, the author, the soprano and the music producer, have gone into the bright lights of Culture Night, and I'm joined now by two thespians and a singer, Roxana McLean, Emmett Kerwin and Jess Kavanagh. Roxana is a poet, writer and actor from Dublin. You'll know her from her starring roles in Love, Hate and Fair City. She also stars in the new film Bicycle Thieves Pumped Up, which premiered at this year's Galway Film Flat. Jess Kavanagh, songwriter, poet and vocalist. Jess has toured worldwide as a backing vocalist with the Waterboys, worked with artists including Hozier, Villagers, Codaline, while also writing and releasing music with her own band, Bark, until 2020. And Emmett Kerwin, Irish actor, playwright and screenwriter, known for starring in RTÉ2's Sarah and Steve and for writing and starring in the 2015 play and the 2018 movie version of Dublin Old School. Good to have all three of you with us this evening. Roxana, you're first up with your first choice. An album I loved, I have to say, Lancome's award-winning album, The Live Long Day. Why does this album speak to you? What is it about Lancome?
I think Lancome and that has brought, I don't know if it's brought or it's come up with a resurgence of people wanting to reconnect with maybe their heritage, their language, their culture, that kind of thing. There's, I wouldn't say like a modern twist, but it feels ancient, but also it feels new at the same time. I wouldn't know about music or about instruments or anything like that, but I just feel like a kind of a physical reaction when I hear them. Lancome had a show at the Abbey last year. It was online, called A National Disgrace. And there's just something about the how they harmonise their voices and the instruments, guttural sounds. Mm.
And that vocal from Rady Pete has both those qualities. It's incredibly ancient and it's right up to date as well. The song you've chosen from the album for us to listen to, Hunting the Wren, what was it about that one, Roxana?
It's just one of those ones where it hits your gut, it hits an emotion, and yeah, there's something just brings you to the kind of other world or something, something about Rady's voice, like you said, that's just so beautiful, and it doesn't sound of this earth, of this land. I think afterwards I read that it was a song about like womanhood, and the wren is associated with women and the persecution of the wren, you know, the hunt and the wren and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, that must be why, and this must be, you know, that kind of way. And I was away when that first came out. I went away that Christmas, and I just had it on repeat, you know, one of those things where you just kind of get a song, and it's quite a long song. But it was like, that was my soundtrack walking through Malta.
Well, what a place to listen to it. Let's listen to Hunting the Wren from Lancome. Lancome and Hunt the Wren there from their album, The Live Long Day. Jess Kavanagh, your first cultural highlight really surprised me in many ways, because I thought, what am I going to get here? Realm of Hungry Ghosts by Gabor Maté. Tell us a little bit about the book and what Gabor Maté is doing here. It's quite a philosophical tracked in some ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. That nice light book to start with. You know, over lockdown, I think we've all been dealing with different, you know, positive and negative coping mechanisms. We've all found ways to cope in different ways. And Gabor Maté, Realm of Hungry Ghosts, is, well, firstly, he's a physician, he's a doctor. He was working in one of the most kind of disenfranchised areas of Vancouver in Canada, working with people who are homeless, people who suffer from array of different types of addiction, working with a lot of people who are First Nation as well, dealing with the post-colonial intergenerational trauma. And so he talks about trauma, he talks about addiction and the empathy that people need around talking about addiction, talking about people who are suffering from addiction. And I feel that, you know, in Ireland, we obviously suffer a lot with homelessness and a lot of addiction as well. And the way that he talks about it with such compassion was just really refreshing for me.
How challenging a read is it, though?
It's tough. I was listening to it as an audiobook, which is lovely, actually, because it's his son who reads it. The stories are quite difficult. They are quite difficult, but I think they're really important to hear. His background on trauma and intergenerational trauma is incredible, though, and it really opens people's eyes to how addiction is so complex and so nuanced, and it's not as easy as, you know, you take one drug and then that's it, you're hooked. You know, it's not about that. There's a lot of inner pain and inner trauma and voids that are in people's lives and ways to cope that have been integrated for years and years and years and possibly handed down by family and so on. And just to look at it with a wider scope.
Yeah, and that's what a wonderful title too, The Realm of Hungry Ghosts. In some ways, Emmett Kerwin, what Jess is talking about there, it's one approach to trying to deal with problems that are in front of us. And obviously Gabor Maté is encouraging us to think using these strong philosophical ideas. Your first choice asks us to think about strong philosophical ideas, but in a very different way. This is a stand-up comedian, a TV show about a stand-up comedian, and it's called Dave.
Yeah, it's called Dave. It follows the life of a guy who's a very upper-middle-class Jewish guy who's neurotic and incredibly self-obsessed, an incredible narcissist, kind of in the same vein as Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, and it's made by the same people. So he uses his bar mitzvah money to make these funny comedy rap videos and puts them up online. And they became huge. They became big viral successes. And now in that kind of same mold that they would have made Seinfeld in the 1980s, 1990s, it's kind of a stylized, almost magical realist version of his life living in LA, trying to become what he wants to be is everyone who'll listen, he is the greatest rapper who's ever lived, and he will be the greatest rapper regardless of what's going to happen.
What makes it funny, do you think?
Well, the first season was kind of quite maligned because there's a real thing with American humor that's scatological and it's, you know, about male anatomy a lot of the time. But it actually, it kind of delves into some things that are quite deeper about cultural appropriation, about white people going into the world of rap music but not having to pay their dues in the way people of color in America have. You know, it's their art form, and essentially he's there as a guest, and he's challenged by this all the time, and he has what's called a hype man, who is somebody who backs you up on stage, who's his real life hype man called Gata. And about the third episode of the first season, they do a thing that they've been doing in TV shows like Mr. Corman, which is on Apple TV at the moment, and they have standalone episodes where the character of Gata got his own episode which dealt with his very real and very serious suffering with bipolar. So it kind of, it starts to represent all of these other voices. And whereas he is the kind of central fugal force of this show, his neuroses is the thing that pushes everyone away. He's an incredibly unlikable character. So what it does is it foregrounds all of the other people and the issues of being in a multicultural city like LA and what they have to go through, and how he is kind of not only impervious to the things that they go through, he almost is somebody who doesn't listen or know about it, which is really problematic because he wants to be a rapper. But it's really funny.
Well, let's listen to a clip that'll give people a sense of what you're talking about. Dave rapping, he's exposed himself in front of his audience. He goes backstage and there he finds two police officers in his dressing room. Stage, head up to the dressing room. Five cops waited in my dressing room. Goddamn, do you blowing up? Look at how they beefing up your security. Hey. I was like, officers, I'll be okay. Yeah. One cop said, sir, you're under arrest. I laughed and jest. Assumed he was just showing off for his cop friends. Open some checks, mix. Sir, I'm gonna need you to put on these cuffs. I'm like, what? Sir, you just exposed yourself at an all-ages show nonetheless. Wait, you're talking about showing nuts, sir? That's like a common joke. You never pull out a ball with your friends or... sir,
never?
Sir, please put on these cuffs.
Wait, stop. No, this is actually happening?
You're... sir,
wait, this is unfair.
Sir.
I'm sorry, I swear.
Sir.
Please hear me out.
Sir, you're going to jail.
I'm like, jail? He like, yeah. I'm like, jail? Yeah. Booked. Bail. Pay it. Scared.
Great fun indeed. That's from Dave, the first choice of Emmett Kerwin on this Culture Evening. Let's move on to your second choice, Roxana. And it's a book again this time. I love this book. 32 Words for Field, Máncan McGann, really celebrates the Irish language.
Yeah.
And you spoke to me on the programme a while back about the Irish language.
Yeah.
So what was it about this book that tapped into the language itself?
It's actually a very similar, it's very similar to the kind of reason that Lancome's album connected. I guess it just peels back the language to... Often people say to me, like, you know, or, you know, Irish is a dead language. Why do you speak Irish? This kind of stuff. And I just can't articulate it. And like, sometimes it reminds me of like a religion where it's like, I just believe it. I just think it should be this, you know, that kind of way. And it's like, but Máncan just basically in speaking the language, we keep this history alive, these magical portals into another world alive, like literally the words that kind of mean something today. When you take one word and you start to kind of peel back where that comes from and look at the kind of origin of that, it just unlocks, you know, thousands of years of story. And by losing our language and by not speaking it, we're losing these stories.
And it's very much, he talks about the connection to the land. It's there in the title of the book, 32 Words for Field. But the land is hugely important in what he's saying here.
Exactly. And for me, it makes a language kind of physical in a way that I hadn't thought about before. And I think we often think of Irish as a language, as a subject, when really it's so much more, and it taps into, again, something within us. I think it's kind of just always there within us, and I think it's because, you know, that's where language comes from. When you, again, peel it back, it's just a communication of this physical thing that I need to communicate to you. And it sent me on just into so many wormholes and Wikipedia kind of tracks and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. 32 Words for Field from Máncan McGann, the choice of Roxana McLean. A book again for your second choice here, Emmett. Tell me a little bit about Far Bright Star, and its author is Robert Olmsted.
Yeah, it's, I suppose you describe it as literary fiction meets penny western. They're not really read Westerns that much here in Ireland or in Europe. It's very much kind of, there is a thing of books that are specifically written for a female market. This is like something that's almost written specifically for a male market. If it was, it's a very thin story. There's not a lot going on in it. But the way Olmsted writes, it's so brilliant. If this was made into a film, the story is so thin, I don't think you'd get anything out of it. The real trip with this is the prose and how he weaves in the kind of elemental struggle of these men, these soldiers hunting for Pancho Villa.
Yeah, explain who Pancho Villa is, and then these cavalry men who are essentially hunting him, trying to hunt him down.
Yeah, so these cavalry men are, you know, some of them are, he says one of them, some of them are adventurers. They're the kind of the dregs of the American army. It's 1916. They've been sent into what becomes New Mexico to hunt Pancho Villa, who is riding across all of this land as a bandit. It's a very simple story that they go out, they hunt him down, and then they get caught in a storm. And that's pretty much it. It's about the struggle that they have against surviving against the bandits, and then the struggle that they have surviving against nature, essentially. There's beautiful kind of passages in it where they go into a dust storm and all of them are illuminated by static electricity, which gives all the men and the horses this kind of blue glow. But it's also incredibly violent. There's a moment in it where a horse bites off a soldier's face, and, you know, incredibly visceral language. It's brilliant. Yeah,
and even though it's quite thin on the plot, it would make a good film from the way you're describing. It's very visual.
I think Casey Affleck is going to make it into a film, and he's going to, you know, I think Hollywood stars often do that. They get these books and they, you know, they go, this is thin enough, you know, it's a 200 page potboiler or whatever, and they get the rights to it. So I think he's going to do it. I don't know. I'm not so sure, you know, for me, the trip was the writing of it. It's so brilliant. The prose itself and how he you know, brings those images about, and how he structures sentences is really the thing. So I'm not sure what kind of film it would make.
Far Bright Star by Robert Olmsted. Music, the X Collective, Jess Kavanagh. Tosin is the name of the band here, and Tosin is the name of the singer. Is that how we say it?
That's right. Tosin is the wonderful singer, and her song Eat, Sleep, Sex, Desire. I've been absolutely delighted to be gigging again. We're just at the beginning of it now. It's wonderful. And I'm a part of this group called the X Collective, and it is a group of R&B artists, hip-hop artists, soul artists, producers, rappers, writers, people who work in the music industry as well. And we were very lucky. We got the Music Industry Stimulus Programme. We got together in an Airbnb in Kilkenny, 25 of us, and we wrote an album, and it was absolutely beautiful.
So the song that we're about to hear then...
This is a song that has already been written, so it's released, so you can go out and you can have a listen to it. But one of the people who I wrote with was Tosin, and her band is called Tosin.
Eat, Sleep, Sex, Desire.
Kind of guy that's got, yeah, the hot stuff. Can you catch a drift? Now take your hint, retreat, it's in. I want to see, I want to see. You tell me you're a rhythm person. You've got a steady job and a full state pension. But baby boy, you never want to mention the beats you keep a woman in your bed.
Oh yeah, it does exactly what it says in the tin, doesn't it?
Right?
Eat, sleep, sex, desire.
What a banger. Like.
Yeah, great, great song from the band Tosin there, and the choice of Jess Kavanagh. Jess has chosen her own art form there into form of music. Emmett Kerwin, you're choosing your own in the next piece you have for us, The Approach, played by Marco Rowe. I remember speaking about this at the time it was out there. Three women, just give us the background, or the kind of setup here from Mark.
It's written by Marco Rowe, and it's directed by Marco Rowe. So it's three women having conversations and duologues. And what happens is we only hear one part of the conversation, and the play is kind of constructed about what's missing in the narrative that each of these duologues is happening. So there's always a kind of idea about things missing, like a missing tooth in something and part of the story. So what the audience has to do is they have to construct the rest of the narrative, but each of them, you're not really sure if they are an untrustworthy narrator.
Yeah, we have three women. Anna, played by Aisling O'Sullivan, a friend, Cora, played by Kathy Belton, and then another character who's played by Derva Crotty in the midst of all of this. And there's a relationship that becomes clear as the play goes on, but it is really about piecing it all together, isn't it?
You know, they talk about kind of an estranged sibling, and the talk about kind of new loves. These things kind of change every time the characters meet up, or maybe the life that you thought, or the story, the way it was going, has basically been just jettisoned, and you have this new story. So the audience is constantly in a state of, oh, what's going on, piecing the whole thing together. But it's beautifully done, and it was one of the first kind of shows that I'd seen as a streamed show over lockdown. I'd seen it as a play, and funnily enough, it actually worked even better as a stream. The hybrid theatre, the way they did it was really, really good. It felt like a theatre show. It didn't feel like a theatre show that was trying to be a film, or, you know, do anything too creative with the camera. You know, when you see a play, you see it in 180 degrees. So they were very careful to try and maintain that theatrical experience, and I think what Landmark did, and also it is live. A lot of the kind of stream plays that have been going on over the last year are recordings, pre-recordings, and it's not the same thing. You know it's not.
Yeah,
so you're always there with them, knowing that something could go wrong in the way it could in a real
And again, I suppose what your third choice, Jess, gives us in some ways is another live aspect to us. It's because it's the film Jazz on a Summer's Day, and this was a concert from the Newport Jazz Festival in 1958. Now, it's not quite live, but it has a real feel as if you're at the festival, doesn't it?
Oh, it was absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, I went there. I went on Sunday. I turned my phone off for the day. It was great. I headed over to the Lighthouse Cinema and got myself a load of treats, and I watched Jazz on a Summer's Day, and it was just exactly what I needed. Mahalia Jackson, she sings, I think she sings Our Father. She has like a gospel version, and I was just bawling. And it was great because it was dark, so I was allowed. I was allowed to feel my feelings, do you know what I mean, in the dark. But just the performances were just incredible. Mm.
Your final choice and our final choice for the programme this evening, Roxana Leclaim, I suppose this is your area, if you like, film, TV. Film, The Vast of the Night, this is an incredible film. Kind of mixes radio and sci-fi all together. Just give us the setup, the basic premise for the piece.
Yeah, so it was kind of a stylized film set in the 1950s. And it kind of opens like the old Twilight Zone episodes. And it's just kind of a classic sci-fi story. There's a guy working in a radio station and a young girl working as an operator, the old operators that used to connect people. And then there's a bit of disturbance in the radio. And they just kind of go on this adventure. But it's just what really struck me about it is that there's no... The shots are really simple. There's one scene where it's the girl just connecting, kind of like what you were saying, Emmett, about just hearing one side of the conversation. It's her just connecting people over the phone. You can't hear who's on the phone. But the scene is about 9.5 minutes long. I can't even, like, I don't know how they do it, but it's so intriguing. They create just a sense of mystery, that classic, like, when you're a child, that childlike sense of mystery and anything could happen, even though it kind of doesn't. There's no effects. It kind of goes in from black and white. The start of each new scene, it starts on an old telly and goes from black and white to colour. But it's just really simple and effective and gorgeous dialogue and storytelling.
Yeah, and the echoes of Orson Welles and War of the Worlds. It really feels like that when you're watching it.
Definitely, yeah.
What a set of choices we have on this Culture Night for you. Thanks to all six of my guests this evening. In fact, John Boyne, Claudia Boyle, Dahi O'Droney, Roxana Leclaim, Emmett Kerwin and Jess Kavanagh for being with us this evening and sharing their ideas with us. Mark McGrath was on sound. Research this evening was by Leah Murphy. The broadcast coordinator was Amandine Paso-Devine, and the programme was produced by Kei Sheehy. Talk to you Monday at 7.